Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Welcome to the podcast. If you'd like to listen to an ad-free version of this episode and all of our episodes, then search True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. That's our premium channel where all of our ad-free and advanced episodes live, all in one place. True Crime Today Premium Plus. Search it on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. Even try it for 3 days free.
Where the line between neighbor and nightmare is razor thin. Welcome to Hidden Killers. With Tony Bruschi, featuring former prosecutor and defense attorney Eric Faddis.
Thanks for joining us. Today we are taking a deep dive into the Brian Koberger case with defense attorney and former prosecutor Eric Faddis. Koberger faces serious charges in the murders of 4 University of Idaho students, and his defense team is mounting strong challenges to key evidence. Eric, thank you for joining me as someone who has been on both sides of the courtroom. Let's start with this. What are the strongest and weakest aspects right now of the prosecution's case? And then we'll start talking about all the stuff Ann Taylor is bringing up. But from a prosecution standpoint, what's your thoughts there?
Yeah, you know, in looking at the case, the cell phone data information that puts Koberger kind of around the scene and allegations that he had visited the scene before the stabbings occurred are certainly significant. But I think really that what they're hanging their hat on in terms of the prosecution is what they believe to be Koberger's DNA on the knife sheath that was left at the crime scene. And that is just so hard to explain for any defense. How are they going to tell a jury that, yes, his biological material was there, but he wasn't?
Well, that's, I think, what Ann Taylor's going for. They can't. If it's thrown out and you can't bring it in, you can't bring it in. The science of this is strong. I mean, there's no doubting that. I know they've thrown out going, oh, it's junk science. Like, just a bunch of words to make people not understand what's going on. You're not going to do their own research. We've done the research. Anybody who dives into this can see and go, yeah, the science is very strong. It's touch DNA. It was on the button of the knife sheath. And it takes a little bit of pressing to get a good chunk of DNA there, enough to identify anyone. But it makes sense. It's a knife sheath for a very sharp blade. So you're going to have to use a little bit of force to get that button up. And that's where they found it. So probably his thumb, I'm guessing, or whatever fingers he decided to use to open the sheath, it's there. Now, the way that they figured that out is they went to an IgG database. There was nothing in the other databases, the ones that the FBI uses and authorities use in the CODIS system to match anybody because, well, he didn't have any real, you know, criminal history that would put his DNA in there. But the IgG pointed to his dad. And then from there, well, kind of weird. We're looking at this guy over here and then you match up Koberger. They start looking at Koberger. And then, of course, eventually he's arrested. They did the warrant. They get the cheek swab. And it's like, I don't have the number in front of me, but it's like 1 in a billion chance that is not his DNA on the knife sheath. So the science is there. There's no arguing that is Koberger's DNA on the knife sheath. It is a fact. It is not debatable. So I'm not even going to go into that because I think that's a bullshit debate and a bullshit argument. But what I guess can be made, and some people do feel strongly about, is the fact that they even got there. And this is an area, to me, I don't really see an issue with because, correct me if I'm wrong, there's not any laws preventing someone who's investigating a case to look at that database, at least not as of right now. There's not. They found the Golden State Killer that way. They found many other and solved many other cases using IgG. So why now is this suddenly a big point of contention that Ann Taylor is trying to argue, to the court and to the court of public opinion as being not allowed? This is a travesty and a violation of rights.
Yeah, I think the why now question is answered by that's the strongest evidence the prosecution has, and Ann Taylor's got to challenge it in some form or fashion.
Yeah.
That being said, I don't think the challenge is very strong. Like you said, you know, she's saying that there is a Fourth Amendment violation. Well, the Fourth Amendment prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures. But if you discard anything, a knife sheath or a napkin or whatever, and has your DNA on it, you lost your reasonable expectation of privacy in that item. Same with folks who give their genetic material to Ancestry.com or that kind of thing. There is nothing legally prohibitive about doing that or about police going to those databases and conducting their own investigation. It's publicly available, and there is just no reasonable expectation of privacy in things that are discarded like that. And so to argue there's a Fourth Amendment violation here, I think is a huge stretch.
Yeah. I mean, unreasonable search and seizure. That's the key part of that unreasonable. Your DNA is on the knife sheath at a crime scene. That makes it a reasonable search and seizure at that point. I get, you know, she's got a grandstand, she's got to do her job, and she is doing it. If I was in that situation or you're being accused of this, I'd take Ann Taylor too. She's doing a pretty good job of bringing all this up in the process, saying, okay, if we can agree that IgG was a unreasonable search and seizure, then nothing else would have happened here, and we have to throw it all out. Facts be damned that his DNA is on the knife sheath. Where do you think the judge is going to land on this? Because as of our recording, we don't really have an answer yet.
Yeah, I mean, look, I am all about fairness in procedure as well as outcome. That's important. We got to make sure that there's no invasion of privacy that is legally impermissible that's going on to try to convict folks. That's valid. That being said, the judge is going to look at this and say, hey, this is, you know, I could go on to 23andMe and do my own kind of research. Police have additional resources and you know, avenues to look into those kind of things. And they got creative, and this is kind of an emerging technique that's being used, but there is just nothing constitutionally violative about it. And I think that that's the way the judge is going to see it.
How do you think this will play out as we go a little bit further down the line? Because she has really thrown everything out, going, hey, all this all needs to go away. It all happens to be everything that really points to Koberger being the culprit, but all of it has to go away. So I get it. You're the defense attorney. That's what you have to do. Let's assume the judge here is going to say, nope, it's all going to stay. Your arguments aren't valid. Thank you, but good night. We'll see you at the trial. Do you think Ann Taylor is going to come to a point where she's going to have a come to Jesus with Brian Koberger and say, look, looking at the stars isn't really a very good alibi. Everything is pretty much pointing to you here. It's very unlikely that you're going to be found not guilty or acquitted on this. Best case, maybe we can get a hung jury, but we don't really have a whole lot of evidence over here that's going to make them think that. So maybe we should try and plead and save your life. Do you think that's where this is going? Or is this a case where it's going to get to trial because, you know, Ann Taylor wants it to get to trial and Koberger wants it to get to trial? Or will, I guess, more reasonable thought prevail here and go, this is one hell of a shitty odd that you're not going to be put to death if you go to court?
Ann Taylor is a darn good attorney from what I've seen, and I think she would be remiss to not approach the prosecutor as trial gets closer, saying, hey, look, you're going for the death penalty, even if you think he was guilty. You're not necessarily going to get the death penalty. It's going to cost your taxpayers millions of dollars. The guy does not have any significant criminal history. This is one where if he pleads guilty to all of this, you should spare his life. Prosecutor, will you agree to that? And then you try to get the prosecutor on board. Then the second step is going back to your client and saying, hey, man, do you want to spend the rest of your life in prison? I know that sucks, but it's a lot better than being put to death.
And the state can certainly say, no, we're not going to offer a plea agreement. We are taking this to trial. Do you think, because it is such a high profile case, because it involves so many people and so many families, and so many people are invested in this on a personal level, and plenty who aren't even personally connected get invested into this thing, that the state would rather say, no, we're going to try and put him to death that we believe we can by taking him to trial, and, you know, the money be damned. We need to do this to get justice. Or do you think they'll settle with we got justice if he admits that he's guilty?
You know, this, in my experience, can come down to the personalities of the prosecutors. I've seen cases where that has happened and they took the death penalty off the table and the person was in prison for the rest of their life. I've seen cases like the Aurora shooter case, where George Brockler, my former boss, went forward to try to get the death penalty. And there were more deaths in that case than there were in Koberger's case. And even with how horrendous those acts were, the jury did not impose or recommend the death penalty. And so it sometimes comes down to who the prosecutor is, what their personal agenda is, and whether the defense attorney can, you know, speak reason to that or not.
What about the surviving roommate who has said that she was downstairs, thought that there was somebody going up and down the stairs? And some of it can be contradicted with what we know about the case. The defense is saying she's unreliable. She shouldn't be able to testify because her story doesn't always match up. And we're talking about testimony that was given literally within hours after all this stuff took place, saying, you know, I sometimes don't know, you know, what's a nightmare and what is reality because of what I just went through. And I'm just paraphrasing that. How strong is her testimony on this? And I mean, could she be a boon for the prosecution or even the defense? Or is she just kind of something nobody wants to touch? Because, you know, number one, you don't want to re-traumatize somebody, but you are fighting for someone's life. So if she's a witness, she should, you know, have to testify. But is it strong enough? Is it something? I mean, it could be used, I think, in some ways to either side's advantage.
Yeah, I think, and let me be clear, I'm not insinuating that she did anything wrong or anything like that. But I think legalistically, this is one of the few items of leverage that the defense might have. When you look at what her testimony, you know, my understanding is that she believes she saw someone in the house and then she went like a stranger and then just didn't call 911 for hours. And then it turns out all of her, or a number of her roommates were stabbed. That is certainly not what we would expect in terms of how someone might behave. Now, clearly she could have been traumatized and might have had prior traumas that contributed to how she acted. But if I'm defense, I'm latching on to that because it is a peculiarity in what otherwise seems like a strong narrative from the prosecution.
Very much true. I think that's one where we need to put it into perspective of this is a young girl. I know she's in college. She's an adult, but she's young. For all intents and purposes, she's still a kid. And you walk out of your dorm or out of your room into the house and you see your four friends lying brutally murdered on the floor. That could start some trauma response right there that doesn't make a whole hell of a lot of sense. And the fact of the way that young people communicate, it's second instinct for us, 911. We didn't have the ability to immediately text our friends and call our friends and come over. But if you're in shock and you don't know what the hell to do or what just happened, it's a bad choice. But I can see someone who's young and inexperienced in life calling friends, going, oh my God, what do I do? What should I do? And maybe 911 is not the first thing on her mind. You know, it's a weird thought. But if you talk to really anybody from 12, 13 on up into their mid-20s about anything, have a conversation for an hour. You're going to find a gazillion things that they will make irrational, dumb decisions about where that are just how? How? Where did you come to this conclusion? At least with a lot of them. And it's not anything that's wrong with them. They're just young. And I don't want to call her dumb because I don't think she is. But she's young. She was just traumatized and inexperienced, I think is the way I would put it.
Yeah, no, I totally hear you on that. And although on the surface it looks unusual, I think the prosecution has a lot of ways to kind of explain that behavior, a number of the ways that you just described. And so could you get a jury to be on board and understand why a youngster would have acted in that way? I think you absolutely could. And that kind of diffuses one of the only potential arguments the defense has.
And if they do call her to the stand, which is probably likely, that's going to have to be handled very carefully and treaded on very, very lightly, because that could blow up in their face very quick. If it's going to be across, like we saw in the Black Swan trial, where they broke her down on stand and they actually had to stop court and take a break because she was hyperventilating. I think almost any way of crossing her could end up in that sort of territory with a trauma like this. Even if you are doing it with kid gloves and being really friendly and nice, and I mean, just the mention of the damn thing, and you are now on the stand and everybody is looking at you because this could possibly make or break the case. I think you got a good chance you're going to have her break down on the stand, even just of the most kind-hearted ways of asking these questions. Is that a risk that the defense would want to take? But I guess when you don't have a whole hell of a lot, you may have to take whatever risk you can get.
I think they have to take the risk, and they have to do it delicately and strategically and with compassion. Look, she's going to be a sympathetic witness up there. All of her college roommates were brutally murdered in the place that she was living. And so as defense, I think what you have to do is you have to stick really to, neutralized factual information. You know, this happened and then you didn't call police right away, correct? Going that route and not putting a spin on it, not injecting argument into it, certainly not injecting blame into the cross-examination. You can save that kind of stuff for closing argument. But during that interaction with that witness, the jury is going to be looking not only at the witness, but how the defense attorney is handling it. And you got to be so careful.
Welcome to the podcast. If you'd like to listen to an ad-free version of this episode and all of our episodes, then search True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. That's our premium channel where all of our ad-free and advanced episodes live, all in one place. True Crime Today Premium Plus. Search it on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. Even try it for 3 days free.
You're in the thick of a true crime saga, every detail sinking in. And then, wham, a commercial about something you couldn't care less about. It's like being served a microwaved dinner at a five-star restaurant. But it doesn't have to be this way. Go for True Crime Today, Premium Plus, on Apple Podcasts. With True Crime Today, Premium Plus, you get uninterrupted, ad-free episodes, extended interviews that dig even deeper into the muck, and early access so you can brag to your friends. It's like ordering the secret menu at a crime buffet. So, search for True Crime Today, Premium Plus, on Apple Podcasts, subscribe, and savor every twisted detail without interruption.